and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me. We just wanted to say a massive thank you, as always, for all the support on the podcast so far. We've had a lot of lovely messages and some really, really good feedback. So thank you and keep it coming.
Please follow, share with your friends and write us a review. But remember, only if it's a good one.
While we're recording this episode, we are drinking a Costa coffee and eating a slice of lemon loaf.
Normally, we like to support local smaller businesses, but Josh was running late, so just went into Costa.
Well, everywhere else was closed, so Costa was the only option, unfortunately.
We'll do something different next week.
This week, we are talking about a story that takes place in 2006.
Actually, wasn't a recent case from 2006 as well?
Yeah, we talked about the mysterious death of Ray Rivera, which was episode 3. 2006 wasn't a very good year for true crime, apparently. Here are a few interesting facts about 2006.
The 2006 World Cup was held in Germany and won by Italy. Train bombings... I told you not to
put that in.
Train bombings in Mumbai... I told you not to do it.
God, all you have to say is Mumbai.
Train bombings in Mumbai killed 2,000 and...
Oh my God.
I just got that out then and then. Train bombings in Mumbai killed 209 people. Social platform Twitter was founded.
Before we get started, just a quick disclaimer. Obviously, this is a true crime show, and we discuss serious crimes, sometimes involving violence and sensitive topics. We do aim to balance respectful storytelling with light-hearted commentary and a bit of humour to keep things engaging, but rest assured, the humour is never at the expense of the victims or their families. So if you're here for bad jokes, interesting stories, and mine and my mum's very silly sense of humour, then please stick around. Viewer discretion, and maybe a sense of humour, is advised. Okay everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. I've got another mystery for you, Mum.
Oh, I love a good mystery.
This is the mysterious disappearance of Brian Schaefer. On a spring night in 2006, Brian Schaefer, a 27-year-old medical student, walked into a bar in Columbus, Ohio, and was never seen again. There were no obvious signs of foul play, no apparent motives, and security footage from the bar shows him entering, but never leaving. What happened to Brian Schaefer? Today we'll go through the details of that night, the investigation, the theories, and the lingering mystery that still haunts those closest to him. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Brian Schaefer was born on February 25th, 1979, and grew up in Pickerington, a suburb of Columbus, Ohio. Described by friends and family as intelligent, charismatic, and fun-loving, Brian had a passion for music, specifically the band Pearl Jam, and enjoyed playing guitar in his free time. He was pursuing a career in medicine, following in the footsteps of his mother, who worked in healthcare. But it wasn't all about academics for Brian. He was known for having a rebellious streak, often dreaming of escaping the stresses of medical school for a laid-back life on a tropical beach. Let's fast forward to 2006.
Isn't it weird, though, that some of the cases that we've just done all involve medical things? So Anita Cobby, the case that we just recently did, was
She was a nurse.
She was a nurse, and her mother was a nurse.
Brian Blackwell went to school. Well, was supposed to go to school to be a doctor.
Yeah, and now this Brian Schaefer is his mum was in the medical field as well. So it's kind of like if you've got don't go to medical school, kids, because you're gonna disappear. Basically, that's what's gonna happen.
We've got an unknowing theme going on here by accident. In 2006, Brian was in his second year at Ohio State University College of Medicine. While he was a dedicated student, it was clear that the pressure of medical school had taken a toll on him. On top of his studies, Brian was also grappling with a recent personal tragedy. His mother, Renee Schaefer, passed away from a rare type of cancer just weeks earlier in March 2006. Her death hit Brian hard. He was very close to her, and the emotional weight of losing her added to the immense pressure he was already under.
I bet it made it worse, really, because he was training to be a doctor. He probably knew all about what was going to happen and couldn't stop it happening, which must be the worst thing, really. Especially.
Yeah, and I would imagine that just training to be a doctor or interest in medicine in general is quite intense as it is.
But being a doctor though, and his mum being so ill, don't you think mentally that would have been even worse? Because
he might have thought that he should be able to do something.
Yeah.
Despite all of this, Brian was known for his positive attitude and strong relationships. He had a serious girlfriend, Alexis Wagner, who he had been dating for about 2 years. Alexis was also a medical student, and the couple had planned a romantic trip to Miami that was set for the following Monday, April 3rd, 2006. In fact, some reports suggest Brian was considering proposing to Alexis during this trip. By all accounts, Brian seemed to be a man with a bright future, on the cusp of something big. But all of that would change on the night of April the 1st, 2006.
It's April Fool's Day.
Oh my God, yeah, it is.
You don't think it's all just a big joke, do you? It's just going to pop up at any minute.
Well, it's a bloody long joke. That week was the start of spring break, a time when students unwind and let loose. And that's exactly what Brian had planned. On the evening of March 31st, 2006, Brian went out for a night on the town with one of his closest friends, Clint Florence. After finishing up some final exams, Brian was ready to relax, and the pair decided to kick off the night at the Ugly Tuna Saloon, a popular bar located in the South Campus Gateway, just a short distance from Ohio State's campus.
What a name for a bar. The Ugly Tuna Saloon. That's like, I bet Mr. Kipper goes in there from the Susie Lamplugh case.
As always, this is take 1 million of us trying to say Ugly Tuna Saloon.
Do you know, everything we do has got like some kind of fish theme.
And it's always names that get us, I don't know why.
Oh.
Names of things
like
and people.
Mr. Pickleberry and all that from the other week.
It's important to note that Brian had invited his girlfriend Alexis to join him that night, but she had gone home to Toledo to spend time with her family before their upcoming trip. So it was just Brian and Clint out on that night. The two started their evening at the Ugly Tuna Saloon, grabbing a few drinks and unwinding after a stressful week. At around 9 p.m, they decided to bar hop, visiting a few other places in the area, including the Short North Tavern and Brothers Bar. Witnesses later reported that Brian and Clint were in good spirits throughout the night, laughing, drinking, and having a good time. They were later joined by another friend, Meredith Reed, who offered to give them a ride back to the Ugly Tuna Saloon where the night had started. If someone said to me, do you want to come back to the Ugly Tuna Saloon? I'd think they were winding me up.
But it's a name you wouldn't forget though, isn't it? So kind of a Marcus employee works.
I mean, at least it rhymes. Is it a silly name or is it clever marketing? At around 1:15 a.m, the trio returned to the Ugly Tuna. As seen on the bar security footage, Brian, Clint and Meredith can be seen riding the escalator up to the second floor entrance of the bar. Brian is wearing a black t-shirt, jeans and white Adidas sneakers, or Adidas if you're one of those people. This is the last time Brian Schaefer was seen alive. Well, this was the last time Brian Schaefer was seen, full stop. I've actually seen the CCTV footage of him going up the escalator, and it's quite eerie really, knowing that that's the last time anyone ever seen him.
Because he sort of hangs about a bit by the escalator, doesn't he? You know, for a few minutes, and he's caught on security cameras, and then does it actually see him entering the bar?
I think from what I've seen, it just shows him going up the escalator, and then he stops at the top talking to someone. So the entrance to the bar was actually on the second floor, which meant you had to get that escalator up to get into the bar. There was no other way in, basically.
Was there a way out, though, or was that the only way in and out, the sort of front way?
Well, we'll get to that shortly.
Okay.
Brian's last confirmed sighting was around 1:55 a.m, about 40 minutes after he entered the bar, when he is seen again on security footage just outside the bar, speaking briefly with two women. After the conversation, Brian walks out of frame, seemingly heading back inside the bar. After that, Brian disappears completely.
So did he actually go back into the bar, or was there somewhere else he could have gone?
Well, I think it says he just leaves camera view towards the entrance to the bar as if he's going back in. So I would assume that he went back in.
Well, you would assume that, but is there any concrete evidence to say that he did actually enter the bar, or was there somewhere else he could have gone?
Well, I think from what I've seen, the only way you can get out from where he is seen on that camera is back down the escalator.
Yeah, that's
which
what,
is covered by cameras.
Yeah, I was thinking with there other sort of places that he could have, you know.
At the front of the bar, there was nowhere else you could go other than in the bar or back down the escalator. And you could see both of them on the CCTV cameras.
So if he's gone off camera view and not come back. He's gone into the bar, hasn't he?
That's what you would have to assume, yeah. Clint and Meredith attempted to find Brian, repeatedly calling him on his mobile phone. They left with other customers when the bar closed at 2 a.m, waiting outside for Brian. When he was not among the departing crowd, they assumed he had returned to his apartment without letting them know. The next morning, however, Brian's girlfriend, Alexis, began to worry. She had been calling and texting Brian throughout the night, but he never responded. This was very unlike him, especially given their upcoming trip to Miami. She called his phone repeatedly over the weekend, but there was no answer. Alexis even drove back to Columbus on Sunday the 2nd of April to check on him, but Brian was nowhere to be found. By Monday morning, when Brian failed to show up for their flight to Miami, it became clear that something was terribly wrong. Alexis, along with Brian's father, Randy Schaefer, reported him missing to the Columbus police.
It became clear that something was terribly wrong. You would think so, wouldn't you, after not being able to contact someone for the whole weekend? If I phoned you and you never replied, like after two times, you know, I'd have the search and rescue house and everything.
Yeah, I think obviously she's been calling him, his dad's been calling him, and for him to not respond to anyone, that's going to be a major red flag, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
So we're now on Monday. He went missing on the Friday. 3 days is a long time for someone to be missing. At first, investigators assumed Brian may have had too much to drink and wandered off, possibly getting into trouble somewhere. They combed through nearby alleyways, checked the local hospitals, and contacted his friends and family, hoping to locate him. But no one had seen or heard from Brian since that night at the Ugly Tuna.
But he could have had too much to drink, couldn't he? And something could have happened that way. Just because they can't find him in the immediate vicinity doesn't mean that that didn't happen. He could have been mugged or murdered or anything, really. And, you know, no one saw it, or they took him away, or he was in a car. So I wouldn't rule that out completely, would you?
No, well, I think also, if you've been drinking since 9 o'clock, you've been out with your mate drinking all night, it's now almost 2 o'clock in the morning, the likelihood is you're pretty intoxicated. So, you know, we've all been there. We've all made stupid decisions when we've been drunk.
Have you now? Can I hear more about these stupid decisions, please?
No, but I just mean you get this this weird, overwhelming feeling of nothing will ever happen to you when you're drunk, and you can get yourself into all kinds of situations.
This is worrying me more and more now. It's the things I don't know about.
I think he was probably just susceptible to making decisions under the influence, to be honest.
You're just speculating that, though, aren't you? No one knows that, really.
This whole podcast is speculation.
Well, yeah, but he seems like a pretty grounded sort of person. He's a medical student, so obviously studied hard, and this night he went out and...
But I think that's also my point. Like, when you're drunk, you probably do things that you wouldn't do if you were sober.
Yeah, that's probably true.
The most confusing part of the investigation came when police reviewed the security footage from the bar. The cameras had captured Brian entering the bar at 1:15 a.m., and briefly stepping outside at 1:55 a.m. to talk to the two women at the top of the escalator. But the footage never showed Brian leaving the bar. He seemed to have vanished into thin air.
Well, we know that's impossible, don't we? So if they never saw him leaving the bar, he was either still in the bar or was there another exit?
Investigators searched the entire building, including restricted areas like the kitchen, storage rooms and the roof, but found no trace of Brian whatsoever. It was possible, investigators realised, that Brian could have changed his clothes in the bar or put on a hat and kept his head down, hiding his face from the camera. He might have also left the building by another route. A service door, not generally used by the public, was a short distance from where Brian was last seen. This exit led to a first floor hallway, which featured access at the time to a construction area with its own exterior exit. What do you think about that?
I don't know. That would suggest some kind of pre-planning, wouldn't it? That he took clothes in a bag or something, or a hat even. Are they saying that it was his intention to disappear, sort of thing?
Well, I think also if you're looking at security footage, you could probably tell if someone is trying to hide their appearance from the camera.
I would think he would still know it was him, though, if people close to him...
Yeah, well, I've heard loads of cases and watched more than enough true crime to know that they can analyse things based on, like, your posture, how you walk, how you stand, how tall you are, all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it'd take them very long to figure out if it was him.
And if there was CCTV footage of him inside the bar, you would see him going in as one person and then never coming out of a toilet or something, saying, you know, he'd be dressed differently, or, you know, that kind of thing. But That sounds a bit far-fetched to me, really, that you went to all this trouble just to do this.
And what about this other exit, this other doorway that's not used by the public?
Well, he'd have to know about that, wouldn't he? He'd need to know that that was an exit and where it went to. It went to a construction area, which is a bit worrying, really. Unless he's wandered through that. You know, what I'm saying is it might not have been planned. He might have seen this door, mistook it for something else, or and ended up outside in a construction site, which could potentially be dangerous.
Well, again, this is going back to what I said about being intoxicated. I know myself, I've been in bars when I've been drunk and I've gone through the wrong door thinking it's another door and I've ended up in like a storeroom or something.
So glad I never knew this at the time when you were going out.
No, but you know what I'm saying? You can easily, like, if you go in the toilets and you come out and you can't remember which way you've gone and you've had a few drinks.
I do that when I've not had a drink. You've seen me, I ended up in the kitchen in that restaurant once, didn't I? And he went to the loo, ended up with the chef.
And that's what I'm saying. So it's an easy mistake to make. Even if there is a sign on it saying staff only or whatever, like, you know, if you've got your beer goggles on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some officers believed that this exit would have been difficult to walk through while sober, never mind intoxicated, as Brian likely was at the time. However, the cameras in that area might also have missed Brian. One panned across the area constantly and the other was operated manually. So that's interesting to know that one of the cameras is actually just being manned.
Yeah, that's weird, because surely if someone was actually operating the camera, they would have seen something, wouldn't they?
But then it comes down to human error, doesn't it? They might have missed him.
Possibly. I just know if I was drunk and I went out onto a building site, I'd probably end up driving one of those bulldozers.
A JCB?
Yeah.
One of the key pieces of evidence in this case is that the Ugly Tuna Saloon only had two exits. The main entrance, which we've already spoke about, where Brian was seen entering and stepping outside, and a back service door that was only used by employees.
That back service door, was that the one we were just speaking about, the one that went to the building site?
Yeah, exactly.
So there was just those two, an in and an out, basically.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying before. If he would have came out of the main entrance and left, he would have been caught on CCTV leaving.
Yeah.
As we've already said, the back door led to an area under heavy construction, but there were no cameras facing that exit, making it impossible to know if Brian did actually leave that way. Is it a bit weird that they didn't have cameras even on that back exit, considering it was for employees, but, you know, employees might be stealing stuff or whatever. I think it'd be...
And if it was all building stuff there, they tend to leave that there overnight, don't they? Like the big, you know, stuff. I was going to say tractors then, but you know what I mean? You know, in case anyone come and tried to steal those or vandalise them or something. I do find that a bit strange there was no cameras at the back. I mean, why not have any at the back?
Once the police had eliminated the immediate area, the search began to fan out from the Ugly Tuna Saloon, with officers, sometimes accompanied by police dogs, looking closely in the street, inspecting dumpsters and other waste containers, and asking residents if they had seen Brian. Flyers bearing his picture, showing a tattoo on his upper right arm of a stick figure logo from the cover artwork for the single Alive by Pearl Jam, one of his favourite bands, and noting a distinctive fleck in one of his irises, were posted widely. I think that's all kind of quite identifying features as well. If it's stuff that not everyone has, you know, not everyone has a tattoo on their right arm, especially of that kind of thing. And that little fleck in his eye is probably quite distinguishable for him.
And I would have thought as well, though, that people would remember him because he was a really handsome man, wasn't he?
And he was tall as well.
Yeah, you know, you'd notice him in a crowd, wouldn't you?
What is it with tall men going missing?
I don't know. There was Ray Rivera and now poor Brian.
The Columbus police even persuaded the city of Columbus to let them into the sewer system and search there, but no useful information was uncovered. At Brian's apartment on King Avenue, 6 blocks from the bar, his car was still parked outside. Inside, nothing appeared amiss.
So, he didn't live that far away from the bar?
No, so 6 blocks. What's that, like a 5-minute walk?
10-minute
walk?
I don't know, it depends how big the blocks are, doesn't it? But the thing is, I mean, did he attempt to walk home? Did he get out of the back way and attempt to walk home, maybe?
Well, I think this is the confusing thing so far, isn't it? Is that we actually don't know if he ever even left the bar. So we know he went in, but according to the evidence so far, he's never left that bar, unless he's found a way around the cameras.
Well, I know we don't know for sure, but we can't rule out that he hasn't left the bar through the back way. And maybe it was the only way he could, being drunk, you know, could go out and decided to try and walk across this building site and walk home.
But even still, don't you think if he would have got out the back entrance, let's say he's gone out the back entrance, he's managed to get out onto the street or whatever, why has no one seen him still? There's been no witnesses that have come forward to say that they've seen him leaving that bar.
But the back of it, though, if it's this building construction thing going on, you know, maybe there weren't many people around there, you know.
I suppose it is 2 o'clock in the morning as well. Okay, so let's explore some of the theories surrounding Brian Schaefer's disappearance. Over the years, countless theories have surfaced. Some plausible, some bizarre, but none have provided any conclusive answers. The first and most obvious theory is that Brian was the victim of foul play. Some speculate that he may have been attacked either inside the bar or shortly after leaving. But if that were the case, how could there be no signs of a struggle? No one reported anything unusual happening at the Ugly Tuna that night, and there were no signs of blood or evidence left behind.
I would think that if there was any kind of a struggle in the bar or any kind of altercation, that somebody would have seen it.
Yeah, there would have been some reports of a fight or something.
They have security on the door, surely. They usually do, don't they? So I think, you know, they would have been involved.
Yeah, and again, I think if he had managed to get out onto a street or something and a fight broke out, surely someone must have seen something or heard something, or there would have been some kind of blood left on a sidewalk or just something of something.
Well, not necessarily, you know, because it depends how quiet it was wherever he exited from. He didn't come out the front way, we know that. So if he did, there's only one other exit, and that's the back. If he's gone out of there, I mean, possibly with somebody else, or, you know, he's gone out of there and found his way through the building site. There was no cameras to say that he did or he didn't do that. So if he did, you wouldn't see him. And then he's bumped into somebody, you know, someone lurking around for whatever reason. It could have all been over and done within minutes. But the thing is as well, where did he go? I mean, surely he would be lying on the floor or something, or as you say, there'd be some evidence of that. But if he was put into a car or something, there wouldn't be, would there?
No, I'm just struggling to wrap my head around the fact that there was no signs of anything whatsoever. The next theory is that others have wondered if Brian left of his own volition. Could Brian have decided to walk away from his life? We need to remember he had been struggling with the death of his mother, the pressures of medical school, and may have been feeling overwhelmed. Could he have staged his disappearance and started a new life elsewhere? This theory gained some traction because of his fascination with tropical destinations and the fact that his body was never found. But many find it hard to believe that Brian would willingly abandon his family and his girlfriend Alexis, especially with a trip to Miami just days away, which we think he was potentially going to propose. Yeah. I just don't think it's that, to be honest.
I don't think he would do that because he just put all that hard work in and passed, he was for his exams. So why, if you knew you were going to disappear, why would you even bother to do that? Obviously, it was like a stepping stone to the future, wasn't it? So that for me is a no.
I mean, I know I'm saying that it's definitely not that, but I like to play devil's advocate a little bit sometimes. So surely that's a good plan, if anything, if you are going to disappear, to set this all up to make people feel like you're not going to do anything, and then all of a sudden you just vanish. It makes it a little bit more believable is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I just think he could have done that any given day of the week. He could have gone off on his lunch or something and just gone.
Well, he could have, but you never know what's going on in someone's life, do you? You never know. I mean, is there ever a right time for someone to choose to disappear?
No, but what I mean is he didn't need to go to all that trouble just to disappear. He could have just walked out one day from medical school and not come back. I know it would have had the same effect. So why go to all that trouble? And as we said earlier, it was a strong possibility he was going to propose to his girlfriend because he was obviously making plans with her. So he's got his medical career on track. Looks like he wants to proceed, you know, forward with his girlfriend, and he's going on a trip with her. So why would you disappear? I don't think it's that at all.
I mean, I've read in quite a few articles that he was borderline obsessed with tropical islands and vacations and stuff like that, so I think...
But he was going on a vacation, though, just a few days away. You don't just disappear to do that, I don't think, anyway. I think something you've not mentioned is that he was very interested in bands. I think he played guitar for them, right, but his ideal career would have been in a band and just travelling around the world or going to an island or something and staying there. A more relaxed way of life, a more bohemian way of life.
And sounds like you.
Yeah, sounds like me, doesn't it? But he was the polar opposite, really. The thing he was doing was just completely opposite to what he wanted to do, and that would have brought pressures with it. But he did have a choice, you know. I don't think he needed to go through all that trouble to actually do that.
There is also the mystery of Brian's mobile phone. For months after his disappearance, his phone continued to ring when dialed, rather than going straight to voicemail, suggesting the phone was either still charged or that it hadn't been turned off immediately. In September 2006, 6 months after Brian's disappearance, his phone pinged the cell tower near Hilliard, Ohio, about 14 miles from Columbus. However, the phone company was unable to determine the exact location and no further leads came from this. Well, this just solidifies in my mind that he didn't willingly go missing himself. Because if his phone's still pinging in Ohio, he could have left his phone, couldn't he? I didn't think of that. He could have left his phone behind, but then 6 months for a phone to keep charge.
I think the phone company explained this away by saying that sometimes these things just happen, that a phone can just kind of like spring into life and ping off a cell tower or something.
I get the ping off a cell tower thing, but I don't understand why his phone was still on.
I don't, because if he wanted to disappear, why didn't he just turn it off? Because that's a means of communication, isn't it? You know, and it allows people to call him and keep track of him, so...
Yeah, because also it says for months after his disappearance. My phone doesn't even stay charged for longer than 48 hours, never mind months.
But you're never off your phone.
What I'm trying to say is, for a phone to still be on months later and it's still being able to ring out and not going straight to voicemail, to me that says that the phone's still on and in charge. So who's charging the phone?
That's what I was going to say. It's someone charging it up, isn't it? Whether it's Brian or somebody else. Or they're turning it off and then turning it on periodically so the battery doesn't go down. But it's more likely, isn't it, that it was being charged up?
Unless it's just a big, possibly like a glitch in the phone system or something.
I think that's what they said. They couldn't really explain it. But, you know, if you've got somebody's phone or somebody's found a phone, could they use it without... anyone, you know, surely people would be ringing that phone, wouldn't they? So
I mean, well, this was back in 2006, so I don't really know how easy it was. I don't even know if your phone was able to have a password then or anything, so I don't know whether it was a case of plug it into a charger, turn it on and it works, so anyone can use it.
Do you know if the phone company checked the records and things? Was there no records of calls going in and out? Because if somebody had that phone, what would be the point of them keeping it if they didn't actually use it?
It just said that the phone company had investigated and all they were able to see was that there was a ping in Ohio still.
So I'm guessing there was no phone calls logged or anything.
No, because, well, if someone has got his phone, surely you're not that stupid to start using it.
Well, some of them are stupid though.
Yeah, true. So I think we're drawing a line underneath him going missing of his own volition.
I don't think he did.
Another theory involves Clint Florence, Brian's friend who was with him that night. Clint was reportedly the last person to see Brian alive, and in the weeks following the disappearance, he refused to take a polygraph test.
That's a red flag, isn't it?
Massive red flag. Come on, Clint. Clint's lawyer insisted that his client had no involvement in Brian's disappearance, but his refusal to cooperate raised eyebrows among Brian's family and investigators.
Do you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of the Ray Rivera case with Porter Pickleberry, and he wouldn't let the police investigate his company. And it's always their friend, isn't it?
I always just honestly think, I mean, I've never been in the situation, obviously, but I always just think, if something had happened to one of my friends or something, and I had absolutely nothing to hide, why would I not do a polygraph?
Well, I think there's a big thing about it, isn't there, that it can give a false positive sometimes. So put yourself in somebody's shoes, you know. And apparently it's not admissible in court, is it?
Yeah, it's not admissible.
It's just an indicator, isn't it? So I think what it is, by refusing to take it, it immediately casts suspicion on you from the police's point of view, which I understand. But I also understand why somebody wouldn't take it as well.
Just in case of the
off
chance.
Well, in case, just by chance, it showed up, you know, it gave a positive result and you were innocent.
Could Clint know more than he's letting on? Or is this simply a case of someone not wanting to be falsely accused? Like you just said.
Yeah, but I don't trust him. I don't like his name, for number one.
We're not getting into this with names again. And then there are the more bizarre theories. Some believe Brian's disappearance could be linked to organised crime or human trafficking. There have even been theories that Brian was abducted by someone who worked at the bar and managed to evade detection through the back entrance, or that Brian met with an accident and was unknowingly hidden or covered up.
There's a lot to unpack there.
There was a lot of theories in one there.
Abducted by someone who worked at the bar. Let's do that one first. Well, again, for someone to abduct him, there would need to be some motive behind that, wouldn't there? Which could link into the human trafficking.
All of these theories really just hang on the fact that I'm still confused why no one's seen him.
What, leaving the bar?
Yeah, or seen anyone leaving the bar with something.
Well, so there's only two answers to that, isn't there? He's still in the bar, which they've searched the bar and apparently he's not. Or he's gone through the back entrance, which to me is the most likely scenario, that you didn't see him coming out the front. He's got to have exited somewhere. And that only leaves one place, and that's the back. But whether that's been, you know, because of somebody else who worked in the bar or something like that, or he's wandered off himself drunk, I really don't know at this moment.
I think the most confusing thing to me, and maybe this does carry a bit of weight as well, is we know that the back exit, for whatever reason, didn't have any cameras. Now, if you're an employee of that bar, you would know that there were no cameras on that back exit. So to me, that's a little bit strange. What I gather from that, the only people that would know that there is no camera coverage at the back of that bar by this construction area that we've discussed are the employees.
Which ties in with the theory that one of the employees may have been involved.
But other than that, I can't really see that happening.
Well, what if a member of staff, you know, said to him, can you just come over here or in here or something? And there was no kind of altercation. And then he's just gone.
Yeah, and they could have, I don't know, stuffed him in a
Who knows,
box.
He was waiting outside the service doors because there was no cameras.
And also, just touching on the human trafficking one, which I don't think is a viable theory, to be honest. This is also a big man as well. He was 6'2", 170 pounds. It's taken more than one person to overpower someone like that and get them out of a bar without anyone seeing a single thing.
And without any cameras picking up anything at all.
So, I personally don't think that's one to...
Well, as a theory, I mean, you know, these things do happen, don't they? But I think in this instance, it's probably unlikely because I think there's easier ways to do it.
Okay, and the final theory is that it was potentially an accidental death and someone in that bar has potentially covered it up. What do we think about that one?
I can't see why somebody in a bar would cover it up if there was if it was a genuine accident. The first thing you'd do is call the paramedic, surely. Why would you start to cover all that up unless there's something shady going on?
Yeah, it seems like a lot of effort to go through rather than just calling 911.
Well, if you're not responsible for it if it's just an accident, you know, and it was one of the patrons in the bar, it's your duty, isn't it, to sort that out, you know, to phone, like as I say, the paramedics or something. And I don't see why they wouldn't have done that.
And weren't you telling me that you'd heard some theory about a band playing in the Ugly Tuna or something that night?
Yeah, I think there was a band playing there that night, and Brian was a big band person, he enjoyed music. And when they finished, they exited through the back, as far as I know, and they were loading up their van. Now, there's some suggestion that maybe they were involved, that Brian would have approached them at some point, maybe, you know, because he was interested maybe in joining a band, or he wanted just some information about them. And something happened outside those doors. And he was basically, I suppose, loaded into the van, or he was injured or attacked or something. And I don't think, if I remember rightly again, the police ever really investigated this. I think they did speak to them, but never went any further, which is a bit strange.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a viable theory, to be honest. I mean, the main thing is, he's obviously not in the bar still. That, or at least if he is, there's no sign of him whatsoever. So if he's been hidden in that bar, he's been hidden very, very well. So the question is, how did he get out of the bar?
Well, the theory we've just said then about the band, I mean, that's ideal really, isn't it? If something had happened, you know, if he was speaking to them outside, there's no cameras to record anything, something happened, they've got a van right there to be able to load him into and drop him off. I'm not saying that's what happened, they're probably all great people, aren't they? But it's something the police maybe should have looked at in more detail.
Despite years of searching, questioning and investigating, no significant breakthroughs have been made in the case of Brian Schaefer's disappearance. Brian's father, Randy Schaefer, remained hopeful that his son was still alive and continued searching for him until his own tragic death in 2008, when he was killed by a falling tree during a storm.
What's the chances?
This family just haven't got good luck, have they?
No.
Poor Randy as well. Just constantly thinking about where his son is and then dies by getting hit by a tree.
I think that's what they say, isn't it, though? When somebody disappears, you know, sometimes it's better that you actually know what happened. You know, obviously, if they're dead, I mean, although you didn't want that to happen, but at least you know you can come to terms with it, and it's a, it is a source of closure, as they say.
Yeah, well, it's some kind of resolution, isn't it?
A at resolution is best word, yeah.
You can work your way through it. Like, you can grieve properly when you don't know where they are, and you don't actually know for a fact that they're actually dead. You're constantly wondering, aren't you? And you're probably hoping that they are still alive somewhere.
While there's still that chance, you would not be able to give up, would you? So it's endless, really, isn't it? And that man was like that until the day he died.
And now he's died in this freak accident, and he'll never know what's happened, if there is ever any resolution in this case as well. To this day, Brian Schaefer's disappearance remains one of the most baffling missing person cases in American history. Was he the victim of foul play, or did he choose to vanish and start a new life? There are still no answers, only questions. In the years since his disappearance, there have been several potential sightings of Brian, but none have ever been confirmed. In 2020, a photo of a homeless man in Tijuana, Mexico, sparked a flurry of speculation online, as the man bore a striking resemblance to Brian. However, upon a further investigation, the man was determined not to be him.
God, this is like Lord Lucan, isn't it? They spot him everywhere, don't they?
I think this is always going to be the case with a missing person, isn't it? I'm sure they get loads of leads saying, oh, I've seen Brian Schaefer here, I've seen Brian Schaefer there, but...
But you never know, though, do you? Because at one time when someone calls in, it could actually be him, couldn't it?
I was just going to say, I think as the police, you have to take it all seriously, don't you? You have to investigate all of the alleged sightings of him.
Well, they didn't investigate that band very well, did they?
For those who knew and loved Brian, the pain of not knowing what happened to him is still very, very real. His girlfriend, Alexis, who had hoped to marry him, has since moved on, but remains haunted by the mystery of his disappearance.
I saw an interview with her, and she became a doctor, I think, if I'm right, and she had kids and that, but she never really forgot about it. You know, she still, to this day, tries to find things out.
Well, I think it's like we were saying, isn't it? How can you move on until you know? His younger brother, Derek, who is now the only surviving member of the Schaefer family, continues to hold all hope for answers. Okay, Mum, so obviously this is a story that we both know quite well. I've listened to multiple podcasts, I've watched countless documentaries on it, but I've actually never took a minute to, like, actually just think about the facts and determine what I thought really happened to Brian Schaefer.
Do you know what this reminds me of? Another case where it was a female, the Maura Murray case. She was a nursing student, but it's kind of a similar thing, you know, someone with the whole future ahead of them, and then... Did she disappear? You know, I'm not going to go into it now, but was it by accident? Was it foul play? Or did she just run off or whatever? It's very similar to that, really. But for me, anyway, I think he just had too much going for him to just want to disappear. But then you never know what's in someone's mind. I've got to say that. But for me, it's got to be some kind of foul play out that back door.
Yeah, I think I've come to that conclusion as well, to be honest. The only logical thing that makes sense in my brain is that something has happened, and I don't even think something's happened inside the bar, to be really honest. I think something's happened outside the bar.
I think it's something to do with his friend.
I mean, but like you said, it's hard to judge someone when you don't know the true facts. Like, you don't know if he actually doesn't want to do that polygraph just because he's panicking that he's gonna fluff it up and make a mistake or something, and then all eyes are on him all of a sudden, you know what I mean? But it is a bit weird that he's the last person that was with him. Something dodgy's definitely happened, hasn't it? And I can't put my finger on what it is, because, you know, there really is no evidence in this case. But for me, it's either someone's killed him, or he's accidentally hurt himself and someone's disposed of his body. To me, they're the only two options that can be explained.
There'd have to be some kind of issue or reason behind him being murdered, though, wouldn't there? So I wonder if there's, like, some kind of backstory that we don't know about. Maybe with his friend, or, you know, a member of the staff in the bar, or another friend. I mean, who's this lady that they met at the beginning? This girl?
From what I've read, the police have not disclosed that there was any motives that they found from anyone, whether it was... I think they've investigated pretty much everyone that was close to him, and there's been no evidence of any kind of reason to want him dead.
No, but the police can only go on what those people are telling them, is what I mean.
It also says that all of the people that were close to him did do polygraph tests, except for his friend. So,
I think it's him.
Make of that what you will.
I definitely think it's him.
The case of Brian Schaefer is a tragic and perplexing mystery that has left investigators, friends, and family grasping for answers. How could a seemingly normal night out end in such inexplicable circumstances? With no body, no solid evidence, and no new leads, Brian Schaefer's case remains open to this day. But for now, it's a mystery lost in time.
Do you know what, Josh? I didn't really like that case, you know.
Why?
I don't know. It's just, I just feel like there's more to it that we just don't know.
Yeah, well, of course there is. That's why it's a bloody mystery.
Yeah, I think it's hard because I do find these mystery cases really, really interesting, but it is also hard because you never know the answers.
Do you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to go to the Ugly Tuna Saloon and just look around. But I think it's closed down. But wouldn't it be great if we could go to the locations? I think it gives you a much better idea. Maybe we should do that.
Maybe we should go on a holiday.
Yeah, maybe we should go and look at them all.
To the Ugly Tuna.
Everyone else goes to like Tenerife, but no, we go.
We go to the Ugly Tuna.
To a murder scene for our jollies.
Well, we don't know it was a murder scene.
Well, that's what I think.
I think it's also just a really sad case that there is really no surviving family members other than his brother, so...
Derek,
yeah. So he doesn't really have anyone to talk to about. He doesn't have anyone to lean on. There's no one else that's going through what he's going through right now in his family.
That's a really good name for a dog, isn't it, Derek? Imagine that, a dog called Derek. That sounds like a film, A Dog Called Derek. I love that. Okay, so that's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you for listening, and we will see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time,
don't do the crime.